From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has been busy. He met today with Turkish President Erdogan about missing journalist Jamal Khashoggi. This follows his meeting yesterday with the Saudi king and his son, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who Pompeo said strongly denied involvement in the journalist's disappearance. The BBC's Martin Patience is in Ankara, and Martin, Turkish authorities there investigated the Saudi consulate yesterday. We're supposed to search the consul's residence, but that's been delayed. What's the latest?
Well, that's right. That's been delayed for days, and it's made a mockery of this idea that the Saudis were fully on board with this investigation. We've been hearing from Turkish officials. They've been asking to get into that residence in order to gather evidence. In the last few minutes, Turkish investigators have gone into that building. Now, that's significant because it's believed that the body of the Saudi journalist, he was killed, according to unnamed Turkish officials, inside the Saudi consulate. He was then put in a black van and taken to this second building, which Turkish investigators are now inside.
Yeah, okay, well, and there were gruesome details to the proof that Turkish officials said they had of a murder. Sources claiming to have heard audio recordings, maybe from a smartwatch. There was alleged to be a video. The New York Times reports at least 9 of the 15 of the Saudi men, the Turkish officials say, came to the consulate to do this, including someone with a bone saw, may have had ties to the prince or worked for security or other government services in Saudi Arabia. So where are we on that proof the Turkish officials said they had?
Well, there's mounting evidence. And I think the clearest question has been posed by the Turkish president. He said to the Saudis, OK, you said that the Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi left the consulate. Prove it. They haven't been able to prove it. What's interesting is the Turks are taking a two-track approach. So we're seeing a slew of leaks in the Turkish media with all these gruesome details. Clearly, that has been sanctioned by the government. And what that is doing is ratcheting up the pressure on the Saudis as well as the Americans. Mm. But interestingly, significantly, the Turkish president himself has not directly accused the Saudi Arabia of killing this journalist. Now, why has he done that? I think some are suggesting that perhaps he is open to cutting some kind of deal. What that deal would actually be, we don't know, but he is keeping open the possibility that there may be some kind of diplomatic resolution to that. And that, of course, is why Mike Pompeo was in the region.
And what is in it for the Turks? You just alluded to possibly, a deal. Erdogan is not known for being a huge backer of freedom of speech. So is it all about his leveraging some sort of deal, or is he genuinely interested in the human rights aspect of the story?
Many people see this, that President Erdogan is using this in order to draw concessions from America and Saudi Arabia. If we just take Turkey's relations with Saudi Arabia, they've been fractious over the years, the rivals in the region. So he may well see this as an opportunity whereby he can draw concessions, for example, perhaps receiving some kind of economic assistance. The Turkish economy is struggling. Another area that President Erdogan actually spoke to Mike Pompeo about was the issue of Syria. America, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia are all involved in that conflict. So there is a scope for a deal. But President Erdogan, as you were saying, is framing this as an issue of human rights. He did know this journalist. He considered him a friend. So I don't think we can discount that.
Mm. And what about on the U.S. side? Is this whole mission to get to the truth, or as some suspect and have vocalized, to help the Saudis craft an explanation that can maintain these two allies, Saudi Arabia and the U.S.? Trump said Saudi Arabia was being presumed guilty until proven innocent, just like his Supreme Court nominee Kavanaugh being very defensive of the Saudis. What is your sense of what the U.S. and Saudi Arabia are trying to do?
I think what this shows, nobody buys the narrative, the story, the line put out by Saudi Arabia and supported by America. They don't buy it in Turkey, and I think many people around the world are skeptical. That is a problem for the US because it questions their credibility. Why is President Trump pursuing this line? I think one of the chief reasons is that Saudi Arabia is a vital ally, and it's not just about oil, pumping oil. So much of his Middle East agenda is done through Riyadh. So, for example, Next month, there's supposed to be more economics, more economic sanctions on Iran. Now, Saudi was absolutely central to this key of isolating Iran. Iran was supposed to be the disruptor in the region. Well, Saudi Arabia, with this operation, has thrown that up onto the air. People, from President Trump's point of view, they should be criticising Iran. Well, people in the region, at the moment, they're criticising Saudi Arabia.
The BBC's Middle East correspondent, Martin Patience, in Ankara, Turkey. Martin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And a note, Turkish officials have now published those audio recordings in the media. The New York Times says they confirm a murder. We'll have more during the day.
One of the most closely watched races in the upcoming midterm elections is the Senate race in Texas between Republican incumbent Ted Cruz and Democratic Congressman Beto O'Rourke. They had a debate last night, and O'Rourke took some harsher than usual swings at Cruz.
This is what you can expect over the course of this debate. Senator Cruz is not going to be honest with you. He's going to make up positions and votes that I've never held or have ever taken. He's dishonest. It's why the president called him Lying Ted, and it's why the nickname stuck, because it's true.
O'Rourke is behind Cruz in the polls, but only trailing by single digits in a very red state. Ashley Lopez, senior reporter at KUT, joins us from Austin with more. Hi, Ashley.
Hey.
And let's listen to one of last night's fierier exchanges. This is Senator Cruz talking about O'Rourke's relationship with President Trump.
With Congressman O'Rourke leading the way, 2 years of a partisan circus shutting down the federal government in a witch hunt on the president, that's not good for the state of Texas. It's not good for our country.
Senator, that is your time. 90 seconds response from you, Mr. O'Rourke.
Really interesting to hear you talk about a partisan circus after your last 6 years in the U.S. Senate.
Now, Cruz said during the debate that it is clear that Congressman O'Rourke's pollsters have told him to come out on the attack. What do you make of his more aggressive strategy last night?
Well, yeah, O'Rourke has definitely changed his tone a little bit since the beginning of the campaign. For most of the campaign, O'Rourke wasn't even mentioning Ted Cruz. In fact, you know, he didn't come up in rallies almost at all. But there have been some Democrats in the state who have been expressing frustration that O'Rourke hasn't been more forceful in highlighting the very real ways in which he's different from Cruz. And with Election Day this close, O'Rourke is probably finding it's important for those distinctions to be clear.
What was Cruz's strategy?
Well, he's been using the same strategy all along, which is that he's making the case that Texas is just too conservative for Beto O'Rourke, who Cruz has painted as this liberal, you know, an extreme liberal. And, you know, Texas hasn't elected a Democrat to statewide office in more than two decades. So it could be that that's a really salient point to make. Cruz has said a couple of times that if given the chance, O'Rourke will take any opportunity to align himself politically and ideologically with what he calls the radical left. Here's a good example of that.
I want to repeal Obamacare, reduce premiums, protect pre-existing conditions, and expand access. Congressman O'Rourke wants socialized medicine, the federal government in charge of your health care and your doctor. I want to keep the economic boom we're experiencing right now going.
Yeah, so Cruz has been making the case that Republicans have been delivering for Texans for a while now, and O'Rourke wants to undo all that work.
Now, O'Rourke has raised a lot of money, a record $38 million just now, making this the most expensive Senate race in history. He is counting on support from Texans who don't typically turn out to vote, Latino voters, young people. Let's listen to a moment from his closing statement last night.
On issues of immigration reform, the fate of Dreamers, nearly 200,000 in the state of Texas, when the Senate voted to move forward on debate for Dreamers, 98 senators showed up that day, 97 voted to move forward, only one senator voted no. Ted Cruz has put his career above the interests and priorities of Texas.
Now, people that are watching this election say it is going to be difficult for O'Rourke to get people who don't typically vote to the polls. What do people think about whether he can pull that off?
I mean, this is the hardest task for any political campaign because it takes a lot of time and it takes a lot of money to make a non-voter a voter. Like a campaign has to get in touch with someone at least six or eight times before they actually vote. There's some research that suggests that. But for a Democrat in Texas, it's really the only way to win a statewide election. That's because the non-voting population in Texas is so big. And the good news for Beto O'Rourke is that he surely has the money now to invest in turning out people who don't often vote in Texas. And I guess soon we'll find out whether that spending was effective.
Well, and the last Democrat, I believe, that won statewide in Texas was Ann Richards or somebody back in the 1990s.
Yeah, almost 25 years ago.
Now, we mentioned that this is the most expensive race in Senate history. You've reported on how the sheer amount of money in this campaign could be making some of the polling data unreliable.
Yeah, this is something that pollsters have been flagging for me because so much money is pouring in, particularly into the Beto O'Rourke campaign. He's doing the more expensive work of turning out non-voters. At least he's trying to, which means there are a bunch of new voters in the mix that pollsters don't typically know how to model for. I mean, since the last midterm in 2014, about 1.6 million people were added to the rolls in Texas, and a lot of them were added in the final days of the registration period this month. I mean, I can't tell if all of that is because of O'Rourke's campaign, but pollsters have told me it's unlikely those voters show up in the polling that's being conducted right now, or at least has been in the past.
It's going to be very interesting to watch what happens in Texas. Ashley Lopez, senior reporter at KUT in Austin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And by the way, early voting for the Texas midterm election begins on Monday. With less than 3 weeks until the midterm elections, many are wondering if the polls are correct and Democrats will make big gains in the House, or if, like in 2016, there's a lot more Republican enthusiasm than is being reported. Former Boston Globe reporter and editor Ben Bradley Jr. just spent some time in a key county in Pennsylvania, which President Trump won. He profiles 12 Trump voters in his new book, just out, The Forgotten: How the People of One Pennsylvania County Elected Donald Trump and Changed America. Ben Bradley Jr., welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
Well, first tell us about this county in Pennsylvania.
This is a county called Luzerne County in northeast Pennsylvania. The county seat is Wilkes-Barre. It's not very prosperous, fraying at the edges, and has been hurting for a long time. And combing through the vote in the three critical swing states, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, I discovered Luzerne County, which is a traditionally Democratic county, hadn't voted Republican since 1988 for Bush Sr.
President Obama won it two times.
President Obama won it twice, but it surged in the other direction for Trump. And he won it by 20 points, building up such a margin in this one county that it was 60% of his victory margin for the state of Pennsylvania. So without this one county, he wouldn't have won the state or perhaps the presidency.
And you profiled 12 people in this book. How did you find them?
Well, I went down initially poking around, and you do what journalists do. You go to community leaders and newspaper editors, talk show hosts, and learn who the Trump voters were and start talking to them. And one person leads you to another. I ended up interviewing over the months about 100 in depth, but settled on 12 whose stories I decided to tell. And I think that this is a window, a deep dive, if you will, into the Trump vote, and that at least more than half the country remains shocked at the candidate as unusual as Trump got elected. And there's a hunger to know more about how it happened.
And you talked to a number of people who all kind of had different reasons for supporting Trump. You dipped into many different views of him. One of the people that you spoke with, Tiffany Cloud, told you that Trump's simple, relatable speak, like huge, big league, or bigly, may have turned off voters in other parts of the country, but it helped him connect with people in Luzerne County.
Well, I think people base most of their vote for president on the extent to which they can relate to them on a human level, how likable they are. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is, in the end, more important than where they stand on a variety of issues. And I think the people that I settle on generally like Trump on most issues, but really liked his style. They just liked his moxie, his feistiness, how he gets up every morning and has a tweet storm and sticks it to the elites.
And they did not feel that he was being condescending toward them, that he was talking down to them.
No, on the contrary. They felt heard and listened to and felt that Hillary was talking down to them, especially with her now infamous remark calling them the deplorables.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that we were talking about during the campaign is that what Trump was saying was not what he actually meant, or not what many people were hearing from him. And you talk to people here in Luzerne County who, you know, they'd hear him say, "I'm going to build a wall." And what they would hear is, well, he's not actually going to build the wall, but he's going to beef up the wall.
Yeah. Interesting. They talked about the importance of decoding Trump, saying that the press was unfair to them, to him, and would treat him too literally by merely covering what he said. We would get into lively discussions about this. And I said, well, that's the press's job. A candidate says something and the press is supposed to report it. And they said, no, you're really making too much of a hullabaloo out of, you know, the Access Hollywood tape. And we know what he meant, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so it was a way of apologizing for him and trying to make his rhetoric understandable.
What about religion? This is a place that is very Catholic, and it's also a place that used to be big in the coal industry. That's gone away. But how much does religion play into how people view President Trump?
It's still predominantly Catholic, not majority so. It's a rising evangelical population. Mm-hmm. Trump's evangelical vote was off the charts. He carried 80% of the evangelical vote. So I talked to a woman for whom Trump was literally sent by God. She believed that Trump was sent to cure America's political dysfunction.
Hmm. And does she feel like he's delivered?
She does. He's appointed evangelicals to his cabinet. Vice President Pence is evangelical. They're willing to excuse the Stormy Daniels business as essentially much ado about nothing.
The fact that he's been married three times.
They don't care. For them, I think the most important issues are abortion and his delivering two conservative Supreme Court justices.
What about just the overall sense of the place right now? In 2018, this is a place where there's not a lot of opportunity. There are also a lot of drug overdoses going on. I mean, this is you could go there and just do a book about the opioid crisis in this area.
The opioid crisis is really bad there, really bad. And it's affecting the entire county. Even if you don't have someone in your family who is an addict, the ripple effect is widespread. And I interviewed the county coroner down there, and he is just overworked and thinks that it's an enormous problem and is trying to raise public awareness about it. But it's pretty bleak in Luzerne County. And young people are leaving. There's a brain drain. There's not a lot of opportunity beyond maintenance and working in warehouses, minimum wage jobs.
And do they think that things have gotten any better under Trump?
Maybe at the margins. The unemployment rate has gone down in the county as it has nationally, and perhaps it's a little bit better there. But a lot of the economic promises that Trump made during the campaign, he hasn't really followed through on. You know, he said he would repeal and replace Obamacare. Well, the individual mandate has been repealed, but he's been really sabotaging Obamacare, and there is no neither Trump or the Republican Party have come up with an alternative plan. He said that he would reduce the deficit in his first 8 years. The budget he filed in February shows a $7 trillion increase. So, you know, the Republican Party doesn't seem to care about the deficit.
But what about these voters? Do they care about those things that he hasn't been able to do?
They don't seem to really care in the final analysis because they just like Trump. I think it's personality over anything else.
Do you think that the Democrats are connecting now with the people of Luzerne County? I remember speaking to the liberal filmmaker Michael Moore, who said, you know, they didn't even try to win a place like Michigan in the last election. They didn't come here the way that Trump did. There's been a lot of criticism that Democrats are ignoring these people that you've been talking to in places like Luzerne County.
Well, they certainly did in 2016, and I think they would do well to listen more to Democrats. A lot of the people that I talked to were Democrats, but felt that the party had left them rather than they leaving the party.
Any thoughts on what might happen in the midterms?
Well, if I had to guess, I would think the this so-called blue wave, I don't know how big it'll be, but I think probably big enough for the Democrats to retake the House, but not the Senate.
Ben Bradley Jr., one of the things I really liked about this book is that you gave us a glimpse into the minds of many people who voted for Trump, but did so with respect for their views. And I feel like a lot of the reporting even on people in the middle of the country that's coming from reporters and others on the coasts tends to look down on them. You didn't do that here.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that because we, the big bad media, so-called, particularly the mainstream media, as it's called, is so often accused of looking down on people in the middle of the country or flyover country, as it's called, disparagingly. And the lesson of the campaign was obviously the big papers, the network news, didn't get out enough, right? They didn't leave
right.
New York, Washington, Los Angeles and get out to talk to these people. So that was one of my goals. And it's all about listening, really. I found that basically people, if you approach them in good faith, like to tell their story.
Mm-hmm. That's Ben Bradley Jr., who is the author of the new book, The Forgotten, How the People of One Pennsylvania County Elected Donald Trump and Changed America. Ben, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Jeremy.
And we've got an excerpt from the book at hereandnow.org.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
A new museum in Washington, D.C. promises to provide a day-in-the-life look at the experiences of police officers. But it's also being noted for what some say it leaves out. Michaela Lefrak from member station WAMU explains.
The new museum stands directly across the street from a memorial to more than 21,000 officers from across the country who have died in the line of duty. Like the memorial, the National Law Enforcement Museum has a mission to honor officers and teach the public about what it takes to be one.
What do police do? How do they do it? Why do they do it?
This is Craig Floyd, the CEO of the National Law Enforcement Memorial Fund. It's the force behind the museum, which is privately funded, mostly by corporations like Motorola, Target, and Glock. Floyd's not a police officer, but he does talk like one.
Our objective is, number one, give our visitors a walk-in-the-shoes experience, what it's like to be a law enforcement professional.
And in many ways, the museum does just that. When you walk in, you see a Park Police helicopter hanging from the rafters and a shot-out pickup truck that was involved in a shootout. There are exhibits about the different jobs people can have in law enforcement, from bomb squads to K-9 units. Yes, there's a real police dog on hand, too. There's also a section on the history of policing in America. Here's lead exhibit developer Rebecca Looney.
These areas touch on the Wild West, Prohibition era, drug enforcement, up through Ferguson, and everything that's been happening in law enforcement in the last 5 years.
Racial minorities and women are represented in videos and photographs, but the museum doesn't directly address their experiences as citizens or members of the force.
It's important.
Ron Hampton is a retired D.C. police officer and the former head of the National Black Police Association. He's excited to visit the museum soon, but he wishes it had done more to reflect diversity in the ranks.
People of color, African-American people, Hispanic people, women, was not a part of policing in the very beginning. I mean, they were left out. It was a white male-dominated institution.
He says he urged the museum's organizing committee to include that side of the story.
And one of the things that we talked about was how policing evolved in this country as it related to black people. If you're going to tell the story, you need to tell the whole story.
Black Lives Matter DC organizer April Goggins says the whole concept of a museum to police offends her.
This is about propaganda. This is about providing a narrative and a picture of law enforcement that counters what we see in the news.
Floyd, the museum fund CEO, says they chose to focus on bridge building, not negative headlines.
There's been a disconnect in some communities around this country over the last few years. I think this museum experience, the educational programs associated with it, are going to go a long way toward building those bridges.
For his part, D.C. Police Chief Peter Newsham says he thinks the museum will be a valuable addition to the city.
For folks who don't know a lot about the strides that law enforcement has been making in recent years to try and develop trusting relationships with our community, I think that'll all be illustrated in the museum.
Floyd says he's confident the model will work.
This will be a must-see destination in Washington, D.C., I assure you.
If you want to decide for yourself, the museum is now open to the public. For Here and Now, I'm Michaela LaFrac.
Yesterday, we spoke with the director of the private and progressive Little Red Schoolhouse and Elizabeth Irwin High School in Manhattan, which began to group the few minority students in the same homeroom so they'd have a place where they felt less like the other. Here's Director Philip Kasson.
Our students of color, some of them, not all of them, feel somewhat othered in their classrooms. And if for part of their day they could feel a part of a larger group, in our predominantly white school, that felt supportive of their academic experience.
But the parents of some of the minority students said it smelled of segregation, and they worried that it gave their kids the feeling of being left out, so the school ended the policy. Our question, is it ever the right thing to group African-American or Hispanic students together when they are the minority in a school? We turn to Dr. Beverly Tatum. She's the author of the bestseller, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? She's also former president of Spelman College, an historically black college for women. Dr. Tatum, the director of the Little Red School, Schoolhouse said they're revisiting this. Maybe it should have been more structured, but that it was very well-intentioned. Your thoughts?
I think it was well-intentioned, and certainly there's a lot of evidence to suggest that there is value to give black kids time together. Sometimes that time together is called affinity grouping, not necessarily in class time, but time in a school, time to talk to each other about the issues that adolescents are concerned about, that can be very helpful.
Talk about what is happening for these teenagers, because as you write in your book in the chapter called Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria, things are different in grade school. Kids are playing in the sandbox with kids that look different from them, and then something happens in high school. What's happening?
One of the things that's happening is the changing adolescent brain, meaning that as kids move into puberty, they start to think in a more sophisticated way. They start to recognize the ways in which race plays itself out. And, you know, there's lots of literature to suggest that black boys in school in particular are more likely to be disciplined for similar behaviors. And also girls are experiencing questions about what does it mean to be a young black girl? And having space to talk about that is not a bad thing. It can be actually a very helpful thing.
The stereotypes that we see of black women are imposed on them. And so they might develop some oppositional behavior. Explain that.
Sure. Well, if I am a young African-American student and I'm trying to understand what it means to be a black person in a white-dominated society, one of the things that I might be thinking about is I don't want to be perceived as, quote, acting white. Some social scientists have said, you know, that black kids think doing well in school is acting white. But that's not universally true. If you are in a largely black school and a lot of black kids are in schools that are segregated, because their neighborhoods are segregated, they're going to the local school. And if you are in a school like that, the honor students are Black. Mm. But if you are in a predominantly white school, the honors group is largely white, and most of the Black and brown kids are in the lower tracks. If that's what your school looks like, then you are likely to think doing well in school, being in that honors track, is so-called acting white.
It's such a vicious cycle because very often the kids are in those lower tracks, maybe because they come from low-income families, but very often there's bias on the part of the teacher that puts a child in that track when, in fact, they should be in a higher track. There's a lower expectation. But what ends up happening is this sense that they don't belong anywhere else, so they start to bond further with the group that they're in.
And in fact, tracking often does result in resegregation within racially integrated schools for the reason we were just talking about. The kids of color are being put in the lower ability groupings, perhaps because they are less well prepared, and maybe that's related to family income and previous preparation. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it isn't about that, mm-hmm. because there's also data that suggests that Black kids who test as well on placement exams are still less likely to be placed in those upper tracks.
You know, the Little Red School said they looked at research. It was probably yours in your book, but to read that was pretty amazing. They'd have the same test scores and
yes.
still not be placed. So what do we do about how to address this notion that perhaps there should be some support without making it look like segregating them or, again, reinforcing the low expectations? This brings us to the Boston Metco program, the Greater Boston Metropolitan Council for Education Opportunity Program, 1994, the notion of busing kids from the inner city, from trouble spots in the inner city, out to the suburbs, very good schools, but all white schools. It was kind of a failure at first. Talk a little bit about that and then what
sure.
happened.
So most of the children who are traveling from Boston into these suburban schools are Black or Latino. Mm-hmm. And often there's a sense of not really belonging. They are not part of the local community. And so when superintendents of these programs look at the performance of the Black kids in particular, they often find that the kids are not doing as well as they would like them to be doing.
There's also, maybe not in Metco, but you read another anecdote about a young Black girl who was in a school majority white. And a teacher was saying, are you going to the dance? Kid doesn't want to say, how am I ever going to get to the dance? You know, I get bused to school. My parents don't have cars. We live in the city. But she doesn't say that.
Uh-huh.
And the teacher gets so frustrated that she won't say she's going to the dance that she then ends up saying something racial. She says, oh, come on, you people love to dance, which adds to the racialized moment that the young girl was feeling.
Exactly. That teacher who made that comment was well-intentioned, but nonetheless projected a stereotype, and it made the student feel even more like she didn't really belong in that school.
Yeah.
But there was a program back in the 90s. I was very involved. And one of the districts I was involved with decided to start a program in the middle school for Metco students. And they set aside one period a day for the kids to meet together to talk about issues related to academic performance, academic achievement, as well as some of the social concerns they had.
Wait a minute. This is a little Red Schoolhouse's homeroom.
It sounds like that,
students.
Doesn't it? But what the difference between this experience and the Little Red Schoolhouse is that they did it for a year and then they evaluated how it worked.
Yeah.
And what they found was that the children who were having that experience improved academically and also they became more engaged socially.
Why? What did the kids say happened?
The kids said they felt more supported. They had the opportunity to talk without invoking stereotypes about some of the things that were challenging them. So if you've been riding on a bus from Boston for an hour and maybe there's been conflict on the bus, you could go to that meeting and talk about it, get it off your mind, and then be more focused in class. Or if something happened in class, let's say, here's an example that one of the kids provided in this study. They were watching a film, Eyes on the Prize, which is about the civil rights era. And some of the white kids were laughing at something that happened in the film, something that the black kids found upsetting. And so the fact that their white peers were laughing as though it were funny and the black kids were feeling like this is horrible was upsetting to them. Rather than walking around agitated, they were able to talk about it, debrief it, so to speak, in that time together in ways that they found helpful.
By the way, the title of your book again, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? Nobody ever asks, why are all the white kids sitting together in the cafeteria? They're bonding in many ways.
Absolutely. And it's also important to say, as you just did, we don't ask why are all the white kids sitting together in the cafeteria. But in fact, at the college level, it is actually the white students who are more likely to be racially isolated. It is possible for white kids still to not engage with the diversity, to stick to people who look like themselves.
It's just such an odd thing. In any high school or just about every college, the entire culture is black. Whether it's the music, comedians that they're following, or the sports figures, it must be very odd for young blacks to see that.
Well, it's true. I mean, certainly the cultural references that you talked about. So, you know, those black artists whose music becomes mainstream, you know, those athletes who are admired by white teens as well as kids of color. Those are physical symbols that many people recognize and appreciate. But at the same time, you can be a young African-American sitting in Starbucks and have somebody call the police on you.
That's something. That's Beverly Daniel Tatum, former president of Spelman College, the country's oldest historically black women's college, author of the newly released Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? It was first published 20 years ago. Dr. Tatum, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We learned this week that Wall Street thinks Uber could be worth $120 billion. That's more than General Motors, Ford, and Fiat Chrysler combined. The eye-popping figure comes as Uber prepares to go public next year. Joining us now from New York is Liz Hoffman at The Wall Street Journal. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Jeremy.
So the last time we heard about an Uber valuation, it was $72 billion when it settled with Alphabet for stealing trade secrets back in February. How is it suddenly supposed to be worth $120 billion?
Well, look, there's almost certainly some Wall Street and Silicon Valley pixie dust baked into that number. Uber did actually raise some money in August from Toyota at a slightly higher valuation, around $75 billion. So what people are paying for here, to the extent this deal happens and it does actually list, is growth, right? Uber is growing incredibly quickly, and it's got a lot of potential to really change a lot of different industries.
But they haven't made any money yet, right?
They haven't. Well, look, they make money. They are not profitable. Uh-huh. They're set to make between $10 and $11 billion this year in revenue. They're profitable in the U.S. in certain markets. They're losing money overseas. And so they've got a lot of different businesses that, on the whole, do not make money.
Now, just for context for people, we're talking about $120 billion valuation here. Facebook's IPO was $104 billion. That was back in 2012. What do you make of that difference?
Well, probably the better way to think of Uber is a bit more like Amazon, and that's pretty charitable on my end. But the idea is that it would be a logistics company, right? That it moves people, it moves things, it moves food, and that there's a lot of different markets that are probably susceptible to someone coming in and saying, we can move these things around better. And that's where Uber would like to be. Now, look, they're a long way from that. Right now, they are a money-losing taxi company for the most part. Mm-hmm. And so it's really just a question of, can they cross the bridge and become a real viable business?
Well, and Uber, unlike Facebook, is not reliant on advertising for its revenue.
It's not. Though remember, when Facebook went public, no one really envisioned that that would be its Achilles heel, that the model was deeply flawed. Who knows what Uber's Achilles heel is, but they have different models. And what Uber basically relies on is a lot of transactions and taking a small piece of that, right? So they do it in their ride-hailing business. They do it in their food delivery business. They would like to be in the business of moving things and making a little money every time. It's also worth noting that of the miles driven in the U.S., ride-sharing is still an unbelievably tiny percentage of it. And so as people move more towards, you know, you've heard a lot of talk about the gig economy, right? That we don't all need to own everything. We can we can kind of share resources. It's going to be a bumpy ride, but there's a broad consensus that that's where the U.S. economy in certain pockets, particularly urban areas, is headed. And someone's going to win it. And look, if you want to put $120 billion valuation on Uber, you have to believe that Uber is going to be the winner there.
They might still be a tiny percentage of the actual moving of people, but they're definitely a high percentage of the double parking, as far as I can tell.
Yes, in my experience.
Are there naysayers right now who think this $120 billion figure is just way too high?
Oh, yes. My inbox is full of them this morning. Look, and it should be – it's worth noting that this is just what two very big banks, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, who are very big underwriters of IPOs, have said they think they could take this company public at. There's a lot of ifs and buts and, again, some pixie dust sprinkled over the whole thing. And so there's no guarantee that that's the right number at all. But look, if it's going to make $10 billion this year, it's not ridiculous to value a company at 10 or 12 times revenue. Obviously, there's no profits behind it, so they need to figure out how to flip the switch and really make this thing profitable, which is, at the end of the day, what public company investors are going to demand. That said, Amazon has very rarely turned a profit, and its stock has continued to rise. So the whole thing here relies on everyone kind of closing their eyes and believing.
There's another aspect of this that I want to ask you about. We've been talking in the last few days about the disappearance, the alleged murder of Jamal Khashoggi, and Saudi Arabia's potential role in that. Well, it turns out that Saudi Arabia is a big backer of Uber. The Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, invested $3.5 billion back in 2016 in Uber. What about that aspect?
So the Saudis are among the biggest investors in Silicon Valley, and that's been deeply uncomfortable for a lot of executives as this story has unfolded. But Uber's CEO, Dara Khosrowshahi, has said publicly he's not going to attend in Riyadh next week. And the Saudis do have a seat on Uber's board. They will be involved in any decision to go public and at what valuation. And so this is sticky, and that's just the consequence of taking money from sovereign wealth funds. You get involved in geopolitics.
One more thing I want to ask you about. Lyft is also preparing to go public next year, but we're talking there not about $120 billion, but $15 billion valuation.
Lyft for the moment is mostly just a ride-hailing app. And so they have a business that looks a lot like one of Uber's businesses. So Lyft is almost certainly not worth as much in the grand scheme of things. But there's a little bit of it's not totally clear like who should go out first, right? If you're Lyft or Uber, there's some value in maybe letting someone else test the waters first. But also it's not clear that public company investors are going to want to own both of these things. Mm-hmm. You lock the banks up. And so it's a little bit of – they've been eyeing each other for a couple of years. Lyft is a much simpler and smaller and ultimately, at least, you know, at the IPO stage, less valuable business.
But it's always there when the Uber is taking too long.
And it has that little pink mustache that
right,
everyone
exactly.
likes.
You always know it's a Lyft car.
Exactly.
Liz Hoffman, who covers Wall Street for The Wall Street Journal, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.